Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway, off-Broadway, and beyond. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to the singer-songwriter Anais Mitchell and the director Rachel Chavkin, two of the leading creators behind the new musical Hadestown, a folk rock opera that sets the story of Orpheus and Eurydice in a kind of Depression-era dreamscape of hard times. Hadestown premiered in 2016 at Off-Broadway's New York Theater Workshop, where early excitement over the show eventually caught fire online and made the cast recording a digital streaming success. That buzz has fueled further development of the show over a run in Edmonton, Alberta, and most recently at London's National Theater, where the musical played in the fall. Soon Broadway audiences will get a chance to see what all the excitement is about when the show starts performances at the Walter Kerr Theater March 22nd. Hi, Anais and Rachel.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So, Anais, let's talk a little bit first about how you first conceived Hadestown. You tell a story about it that sounds to me a little bit like divine inspiration. Tell me a little bit about that moment and when that was.
Oh, that's funny. I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, oftentimes, you know, I'm a songwriter, and oftentimes the impetus for a song isn't like, it's not like I have a grand scheme about what I want to do. Just a line will come, and then I'll kind of follow it into the labyrinth. And there's a moment I was driving in my car. I was in my early 20s, and I was thinking about my boyfriend at home, and I was driving for miles, and
Were you touring as a musician at that point?
Yeah, and early on, just playing coffee houses and, like, driving ridiculous distances to get to, you know, a tips gig thing. So these lines came into my head, and they were the melody of what is now the song called Wait For Me, but the lyrics were different, and they went... wait for me, I'm coming in my garters and pearls. With what melody did you barter me from the wicked underworld?
Whoa.
Yeah, did I never
I
tell you
know
that?
Those alternate lyrics.
I'm so glad.
Wait, why? So, all those words came at once in a rush? To that's what sounds like divine inspiration to me, is for, like...
Yeah, I don't know.
Couplets to
you
arrive
know, it's not,
fully
it's
formed,
not
you know?
How I roll. Like, I am a very slow writer, and it's certainly, like... That kind of fully formed thing doesn't seem like the norm for me, but then there are times when that happens, and those four lines came all at the same time, and they seem to be just about the Eurydice and Orpheus story because of the underworld, and so I started to think about it and just get really excited about the idea of telling a longer form story.
Was that the first time you'd sort of had that impulse? Because you're not a musical theater person.
No.
You are now, but you were
apparently
not at the time.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, I do love music theater. I've always loved Les Mis, and Sweeney Todd made a big impression on me early on. But I think I was bumping up against this thing where I love songs so much, you know, and but even at my favorite songwriter's show, I'd start to get a little like fidgety halfway through because of the thing of just so many tiny climaxes in a row, and at the same time I'd watch a terrible movie all the way to the end because I had to find out what would happen, and just wondering, you know, why is it so powerful, that question, like, what's going to happen, and what would happen if you put all those songs in service of a longer arc.
Right. And so when did that first idea happen? That was like 12 years ago, or that was, what year was that?
Yeah, maybe even a little longer because it was just the first spark of it.
Okay, and that would, like, 2006-ish, is that the word thing?
Yeah.
Okay. So And then you think to yourself, I'd like to tell a larger story, and it's inspired by Orpheus and Eurydice. And then what does it become at first? Because I know this, it first existed as sort of a concert that you did with your friends, right? Like, was this like a concept album in your head? What was it?
Yeah, you know, it was always a staged piece in my head.
Okay.
Like, early on, so I used to live in Vermont.
Yep.
For most of my adult life, and when those songs started coming, I enlisted the help of, like, my friends in Vermont, one of whom is still with us. Michael Chorney is one of our orchestrators, and he, from the very get-go, was arranging my songs for this band of his in Vermont. There was an early director named Ben Matchstick, who came from the, like, bread and puppet world.
Oh, yeah, which is up there, yeah.
It's way up there,
yeah.
Totally. And then all the actors and musicians were friends of ours in Vermont, and so... we put on the show up there 2 times in a row, 2 years in a row, in a sort of more, much more abstract version of what we're doing now.
And when did the impulse occur to you to you know delve further into sort of staging it and making it more of a musical kind of theater piece?
Right. So after that initial kind of staged thing, we I went into the mode of working on the album, which took a few years, and then we ended up touring that music as a concert for a couple years. So it really like took a break from the stage.
Right.
But I'd always wanted to get it back into the theater in some way, and it just took a while to find the partners for that, and I'm sitting next to you, the kind of keystone of that next phase of stage work.
Yeah, and how did you two connect, Rachel? Talk about how when you first came.
We met in 2012, initially, actually. Anais came to see Comet when we were at Ars Nova. I think maybe, like, you had begun working with Dale Franzen.
So that would have been the very earliest production of Natasha Beyond the Great.
That was the very first incarnation.
That was at Ars Nova in the basement,
yeah, like,
for folks who didn't see it.
Yeah, 87 yeah. crushed yeah. seats and lots of vodka. and Anais, you'd begun working with one of our producers at that point, mm-hmm. and were like seeking out musical theater, so far as I understand it,
yeah.
and people working on it. And a mutual friend, actually a really great drummer, connected us, and we sort of began dating, basically, over the course of the year. And I think we, like, officially began working together in 2013 when I was in London, and we had, like, a five-hour Skype session. and just began talking through the concept album and sort of what was already there and what was happening and where there were gaps in songs, and it was, like, our first dramaturgical meeting, and of which we've now had a lot.
Yeah. And what was already there? Like, what did you respond to in it that...
First and foremost, the music is just, like, heartbreaking. It's so rich. It's so... the orchestrations that Michael Chorney and then Todd Sickafoos, who produced the album, created, and Anais'
melodies.
We should
say, this was in its first incarnation as an album, this was before the cast recording
totally.
From the workshop.
Right.
So this was the, I guess, let's call it the concept album,
it's
right?
It's properly a concept album,
right.
yeah. And the... just the melodies of it. I mean, that song, Wait For Me, that Anais told the story of, is just hauntingly beautiful and immediately evoked a ton of images. And then I was so moved by the poetry as well, by the lyrics and the philosophy in the lyrics and the delicacy of them. So I just fell in love with the music very purely and then began really enjoying talking to Anais more and more.
And so then how did you, the two of you together, conjure the world? It's set in a very sort of, I was about to say specific, but that's not quite the right word, but it has a very, like, specific texture to it, and it's not quite realist and, you know, not quite a dream. How'd you come to that? Was that in your head from the beginning, Anais, or...?
I think it's been a lot of trial and error on
yes.
the part of, you know, these last few productions we've done. You should maybe talk about it.
No. The trial and error is a good thing. I mean, I think the image that has really stuck with me that Anais had said at one point is, like, trying to focus a camera, and that actually we were trying to, like, dial it into focus, and then at one point we actually over-focused it, and suddenly everything... I should say the first thing Anais ever said to me when we were working on this piece is this is a poetry piece, not a prose piece. And so what that has meant has both that it rhymes, certainly, like in its most basic form, but also that it needs a gauziness of world. So yeah, there's like a bunch of different specific things that we're invoking, including there's obviously the trombone in the orchestrations, and we looked at like research of Preservation Hall and talked about music spaces and the culture.
Preservation Hall is a space in New Orleans.
Yeah. Really extraordinary historic jazz bass in particular, and like looked at all these claustrophobic clubs for gathering for old storytelling and for music, which is what Anais like breathes out of every fiber of her being, and that is what this piece is at its core, is a music event. And so we wanted to make a space that could get really theatrical, and now it does. Like the number Wait for Me is this sort of massive spectacle, but at its core it's also a really intimate space that is rooted in clubs.
And I would just add, like, that I think, you know, when I first saw Great Comet at Ars Nova in that tiny space, that's exactly what it felt like to me, like the weirdest, most awesome rock show, and then also a totally delightful, accessible story. Right. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons I so admire and have gravitated towards Rachel's work is that she so deeply loves and gets what music is, you know.
Even though I don't play it.
Yeah.
I know nothing about it, actually. But I think, like, the idea, I love being in a space with musicians. It's my favorite thing. And I think I'm always interested in creating a world that, A, one wants to be inside, both the performers but also the audience, that you want to inhabit this space together. And then there was just something so ancient about what Anais was doing in this, in terms of both the myth and the ancient act of retelling a myth for your times.
Right. That first production at the workshop, for any listeners who didn't see it, had a very in the round kind of concert feel to it. It was very highly staged, but it was like, you know, concerty. It was a little bit like, and that's what you were saying for that first production of Great Comet. What will audiences see on Broadway? Because that's the curve's a proscenium space.
It's pretty different.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope that like what anyone who saw it at New York Theatre Workshop, I hope is going to recognize the DNA spiritually in like a heartbeat. We've talked a lot about like the vibe, and that we actually lost the vibe for a moment of development and then worked to get it back in the design and the culture of the performance. But also they're going to see, and certainly new audiences to the show are going to see, an enormous world that is this, like, starts as this claustrophobic, intimate, I should say, like, really cozy club, and then just opens out into this industrial world.
Right, yeah. And so, Anais, tell us a little bit about once you figured out that it was about Orpheus and Eurydice, and then you started digging in, what did the story then become about for you? What did you find as you were sort of tugging at all those threads?
Well, I think from the get-go, you know, one of the draws of the story for me is that there's this protagonist who's a singer-songwriter, musician, and obviously the story has been told many times because I think composers are really drawn to that that story. But also this idea of this young idealist who crashes up against this world, the underworld, which in our telling is a sort of it's something like a company town, or it's a place of relative wealth and security that people have traded a sense of aliveness for a sense of certainty, and that just felt very rich 12 years ago, and it just continues to unfold in different ways. You know, we're dealing with an above ground world where the seasons and the weather are unpredictable, and that is, you know, the realm of Persephone, the queen of the seasons, and at some level it's attributable to this deteriorating marriage between she and Hades, the king of the underworld, who is the industrialist. And, you know, one of the things that Hades is, one of his projects is he's walling off his nation state from the poor people outside of it. And so those things, you know, obviously have taken on a whole new...
I mean, that song in particular was very striking as the show was first performed at the workshop in, I guess it was the spring of 2016, and we were sort of in the height or depths of the presidential election mm-hmm. campaign then. And it, what was that like to sort of see that, feel that resonance in a way?
Yeah.
That must have been surprising, I imagine.
So weird. So weird because, right, and that song is one of the first ones that I wrote for the show, and that's one of those rare moments where it kind of tumbled out, and I didn't even know quite what it was. And I've been singing it in my shows for, you know, literally a decade, and then suddenly it was, people were just responding in a really different way. I had thought maybe it would go away after the campaign, but apparently not.
No. Yeah. Right. Right, yeah. And what, I know that it sounds like there's been a fair amount of development in terms of what even the score is, and there's been, you know, additions in songs and additions in kind of chorus.
Yeah.
I know I've talked to you both about. Tell us a little bit about kind of the development of what the show has become and how it has kind of expanded out.
Yeah, I mean, the ensemble is a big one, and that was something that we began talking about before New York Theatre Workshop, but didn't have the money or the space to
right.
put them. And I think what the addition of the Workers' Chorus, as they're called, has done is both it's widened the scope of the show in terms of, like, the joy. Like, they're just this extraordinary mm-hmm. group of dancer singers, and so getting to add all those both voices and bodies has just really enriched the life of the show. But then also it's radically sort of exponentially deepened the love story at the center, because of course the central event is Orpheus comes down to the underworld to try to bring his lover back to the surface with him and to change the laws of space and time to do so. And one of the things that a dear friend said after the workshop is, I get what that walk, what Orpheus and Eurydice's walk means for Eurydice. It means she gets out. But what does it mean for Hadestown? And so now with the addition of the Workers' Ensemble, the political, like, undertones of what happens when someone, whether they were born to do so or not, and I think actually our Orpheus, we've worked really hard to make him not a natural leader, but actually someone who is forged in, like, the crucible of losing his lover, that when someone dares to step out and speak truth to power and ask the question, why do things have to be this way, that can change the world, not just for the love of his life, but also everyone who's living under these oppressive conditions. So I think that's probably the biggest spiritual and logistical change to the show from my perspective.
Yeah.
I love that, what you just said. That's not, it made so much sense to me. The show makes sense like that. I will say that, like, I think people that saw the show at the workshop are going to experience, like Rachel said, the same DNA, the same culture, but a really different show, like a pretty radically different show. And there's been a lot of work in terms of, you know, and me coming from not from music theater world, not from the dramatic writing world, it's been a long sort of masterclass working with Rachel and our dramaturg Ken Chernelia and the theaters that we've worked with. Mm-hmm. I remember early on at the workshop, Jim Nicola, the artistic director there, I was sitting in his office, and he's like, "So, poetry is, you know," he was eating a sandwich, and he was like, "Poetry is, I'm standing next to my sandwich, I'm looking at it, and I'm expounding on the beauty of this sandwich. Drama is, I'm actually eating this sandwich right now in front of you, you know." And for me as a songwriter, oftentimes, you know, the songs are, they are a suspension of a moment. They are sort of like, let's dwell in this mystical space for 3.5 minutes, where drama demands that you, you know, are in real time, you know, having experiences, making change, you know, making decisions, A leads to B, that kind of stuff. And so I think a lot of the work of the past few years has been to try to go into these worlds which exist, these 3.5 minute worlds which do exist as a sort of suspension of reality, and get into them, you know, what are the stakes and what is the journey from A to B? So there are going to be a lot of those moments, I think, that people who were asked to be pretty patient at the workshop with just, like, being with the music, hopefully there will be more for their dramatic mind to follow.
And so are there a lot of new songs, or are there, is it more just sort of reconfiguration of songs or rethinking of songs?
Yeah, I would say more the latter, that it has always felt like the show was sort of at capacity for, you know, mm-hmm. how many musical themes, right. you know, and we're trying to, like, streamline it and condense it and stuff, but to make those songs that exist work harder on behalf of the storytelling has been the project, and so sometimes that's a recit, you know, interlude in the middle of the song, or an intro or an outro or a bridge, where we can be in the moment, moment to moment.
What do you each consider sort of the biggest things you have learned in the journey from the workshop to you played Edmonton, which, first of all, how did you get to Edmonton? And then you were just at the National. What are the biggest takeaways that kind of helped, Rachel, as you said, kind of focus the lens?
Yeah, yeah. Don't all Broadway shows go to Edmonton?
I mean, it's like New Haven,
classic,
Chicago.
Classic.
Yeah.
It was very cold there. And they were very good to us. It was wonderful. I mean, I think actually, I guess I would point to that moment as actually the biggest learning experience for me. And it was really hard. Like, I was spontaneously weeping at all hours of the day because I was like, I have killed it. Like, we actually have killed this thing. And I should say, I've never, ever worked on a show as hard to direct as this show. I've never worked on something as delicate. And I think for all the reasons, like, implied in the thing Anais was just talking about, like, you come to this world of musical theater, as, like, both a worshiper and also as, like, an alien. And so that the... And so the songs, the writing is just unique. It is so singular in terms of the way music functions, and the like gossamer of the world is spun through every lyric and every melody. And so how the show has wanted to inhabit space, and whether it wants to become a quote-unquote representational musical with, like, real railroad tracks, for example, versus staying as a concert with microphones, what has slowly become clear is it didn't want to be either of those things. Like, it felt like a betrayal of theater to not take the leap into, like, seeing these scenes in full, which was not a step we really were ready to take at New York Theater Workshop. But in Canada, we learned the really hard lesson of going too far into realism.
Okay.
And so suddenly the event had lost its spirit. And so with our set designer, Rachel Houks, beautiful blessing, between previews one and previews two, I actually cut 3/4 of the act one set. And suddenly it was like, oh my God, the whole thing blossomed back to life. And the actors remembered everything from a 4-hour rehearsal, because as soon as we retapped into the vibe of sharing space to tell a story, it was like, oh, this was always what it was meant to be. And when a choice is the right choice, typically it's actually pretty easy to execute. So that was a really painful lesson, but a really good lesson that then has guided every step following that time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was also, I'll just talk about the National real fast, because that, you know, we just came out of that production, and it was like such an incredible space to be developing this show en route to Broadway, because it's so different.
Yeah.
You know, and it felt, I mean, it's a Greek space,
right.
and it felt so classical. Like, the whole vibe was, you know, it's made for Shakespeare, it's made for, you know, this really old storytelling, and like Patrick Page, our Hades, you know,
yep.
he is the Shakespearean, like, expert. Like, he, you know, suddenly it felt that our kind of, I don't want to say scrappy, but, you know, like, we were this, like, folk show, like, came from this barn or whatever, was suddenly on this Shakespearean level. And all of the feedback we were getting, you know, Rufus, the artistic director there, yeah. is just like such a dear man and so intelligent. And his instinct would be like, let's not put a button on the end of it. Let's have fewer buttons in this show. You know, let's go for less applause because we want to stay in the, which is potentially the opposite of what most shows on Broadway would be going for.
Right.
So it did feel like really connecting with just like this old school integrity of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
We should actually talk a little bit about the cast. You mentioned Patrick, who's been Patrick Page, who's people have seen on Broadway in a thousand things, from Spider-Man to you know, The Lion King. So he's your Hades, and he's been with the project basically from the very early on, since before the workshop, right?
Yeah, totally.
Amber Gray.
Yeah, and Prince. Amber Gray has been with the project almost as long as I have. She was in the very first development workshop we did at Dartmouth College with NYTW.
Oh, okay. And so she is Persephone, and she was in Great
Comet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She's had two babies since she started working on this project, I'm told.
Yeah, so
true.
Amazing.
Right? And so, do you find it hard, or do you enjoy writing for other people as opposed to yourself? Were you always writing these songs with the idea that other voices would sing them?
I love writing them for other people. I mean, and at this point, there's not that many songs I can sing from the show because I feel, you know, I feel like they... And I've learned so much from all the actors we've worked with along the way, in every production. And I certainly feel like our five principal actors now are... They are so close DNA-wise to who their character is that I almost can just picture them, and then the language comes.
It's I feel like you have gotten, particularly in the last couple of months, like really beginning the like singular joy of a musical theater writer to write for a particular performer, which I recognize as like a lot of playwrights as well do, where they're once they picture the right person in their brain, everything begins to blossom. And so like Andre DeShields has taught us so much about the character of Hermes.
He joined the cast for The National.
Yes, and had done a bit of development with us prior to that. And there was one like moment during a workshop when Andre just at the end sort of very lightly said, "What is doubt?" And it like ended up leading to this massive revision of the song Doubt, which is the climactic sequence in the show.
Yeah.
And then
he can throw down the wisdom, you know, in a dramaturgical discussion. I mean, it's pretty unbelievable.
Totally. And then Eva Noblezada and Reeve Carney,
go ahead.
There are two young lovers, Eurydice and Orpheus, and like the two of them are so like this bundle of toughness and sweetness between, and I think in particular I'm thinking about Aeneas has done a number of revisions on the character of Orpheus recently. Actually, that's been a bunch of the focus of the work between The National and here, and a lot of that is thinking about how I think Reeve inhabits the world as this incredibly touched musician, and that word is now sort of a big hallmark in the in the piece. I hope it's okay.
Yeah,
to
totally.
Say.
Yeah, and it felt like that was the direction that character always wanted to go.
Well, it's been easy. Like, we did a ton of staging yesterday through the early part of Act One, and it's like so thrilling. And again, it's suddenly when something comes naturally and easily, you're like, oh, that was the choice all along.
Yeah. We often talk about this show, like, you know, there's so much work has gone into it, so much kind of generative, like creative work on the part of so many people. And at the same time, because it's a myth, it also feels like it just is like coming out of the ground, you know, or we talk about like the sculpture in the stone where we're just like chipping away and maybe it's a costume piece and we're like, oh, that scarf, that's the sculpture in the stone, you know, or some choreography move, or there is the sort of thrill of resonance when you tap into that just very deep aspect of mythology.
Yeah. One of the things that has kept kind of enthusiasm for the show going, even though it was only, you know, it was on for a few months at a little off-Broadway house that not that many people got a chance to see just because it's a small space. But then you made a cast recording that kind of blew up online. It became really popular and people really responded to it. What did that? How do you feel like that translated for you? You know, IRL. Like, did this sort of digital enthusiasm kind of bleed over into how you guys experienced how people responded to the show?
I guess I would say, and I'm sure you have a more specific relationship to this, but like my experience of this show first and foremost was this concept album that had a cult following,
and then
like I got attacked by half of my students because I was teaching at the time when I began to work on this because they were like, oh my god, they were just acolytes of the album, and then so it felt very natural that the cast album had exactly sort of the same feeling, and that was the central idea of doing it as a live recording versus a studio recording. It felt like a bootleg in the way that you're just like, I can remember listening to bootleg cassettes as a kid and feeling like, oh my god, I have this in my hot little hands, and maybe other people have, you know, a copy of this cassette, but this one's mine. And so I think it just felt very in step with the history of the show that the cast album had that same sort of special vibe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's well said. I remember being uncertain whether we should make a recording of that show because there was this studio record and because we were still developing it, and you know, but when we hit upon making it a live record, it felt like it all came into focus, and I'm so grateful that we have that document of that time, because
not many off-Broadway shows get it, actually, we should say.
That's right. Yeah, we're so lucky that we were supported by the record label, by Warner, and that the producers thought to throw down and make it happen. But it was a special time and a special group of humans in that room, and I'm so glad that we have a document of that. And I mean, I just think that's the beauty and the power of music and writing songs, is that they walk on their own legs in the world, you know, in a way that... it's just beautiful that as many problems as I have with, like, this world of file sharing that we live in or whatever, you know, everything's free now. But I love that music is free and accessible to people, and they can find music that moves them and share it. It's, like, makes a lot of sense.
Are you excited to write another musical theater piece?
Like someday, you know.
But not for a while. Is that the?
Yeah, I'm excited to make some music that has no dramaturgical implications at all.
That you won't have to have five meetings about.
Yeah.
But you're each song.
Yeah. Now, I've been working on this project. It's a new. It's a new sort of folk band. It's called Bonnie Light Horseman, and it's all sort of reworked in a kind of vibey, loose way, traditional material, and it's with a couple other great musicians, and that has been a sort of like a place of rest and just be able to just sing and enjoy music without thinking too hard about the, you know, what each word means. But it's been, you know, the thrill and honor of a lifetime to work with you, Rachel, and our whole same team. I'm so proud of what we're creating still, and I can't imagine that I would turn my back on that world, you know, so who knows? Yeah. Hopefully life is long.
Yeah. And what's next for you, Rachel?
After this, basically the day after Hadestown locks, I start rehearsals for Bess Wohl's Continuity at MTC, which is a really funny and very upsetting play about climate change set on the set of a climate change action thriller. And of course, Beth and I made Small Mouse Sounds together. So
yes,
it's another kind of home-based collaboration for me.
Cool.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see what comes next for both of you. Thanks, guys. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Talk to you.
That was Anais Mitchell and Rachel Chavkin, two of the creative forces behind Hadestown, starting Broadway previews March 22nd. If you like what you've heard on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes and subscribe wherever finer podcasts are dispensed. On the next episode of Stagecraft, I'll talk to Eva Price, the rising young producer behind the Broadway runs of the edgy new revival of Oklahoma and the upcoming Alanis Morissette musical, Jagged Little Pill. Until then, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.